Hello and welcome to the This Week in Cleantech podcast. Each week, our host, David Hunt, speaks to a leading startup, CEO, executive, thought leader, or industry insider in the cleantech sector. Focused on the clean energy and clean mobility transitions, each guest shares the highs and lows of their cleantech journey, their industry insights, and their vision and hopes for the future.
Hello, and thank you for joining me again on the This Week in Cleantech podcast. I started this podcast as a bit of a hobby, as I love the intersection of business and clean technology. There is, though, only one reason I've been able to access the amazing CEOs and thought leaders I've interviewed so far, and that is because of my day job as CEO of Hyperion Executive Search. Hyperion have also funded the production and hosting of the podcast. As such, I thought it only fair that the company should be acknowledged as a sponsor of the podcast, which from now on it will be. My guest this week is Liam Berryman, CEO and co-founder of Nilumbo, a nanotechnology company. As CEO, Liam has led Nilumbo from a garage startup to an emerging company that is solving major problems for top-tier clients and has received more than $17 million in private funding, along with another larger round, which you'll hear about during the podcast. Liam attended UC Berkeley for chemical engineering and is a lifelong runner, reader, and surfer, as well as a proud member of Young President's Organization, the YPO, at the Teal Fellowship, and is a Forbes 30 Under 30 for Energy. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hello, Liam. It's great to have you as a guest on the This Week in Cleantech podcast. I'm really excited to hear about your journey and, of course, about another technology which isn't as obvious or visible as a wind turbine, solar panel or a battery, but has the potential to massively impact the battle to reduce carbon emissions. And that's really what we're all here to achieve. So before we get to the technology, though, can we share a little bit about what led you to be an entrepreneur and to co-found a company? Because it seems that you didn't have really any great previous work experience before getting to that point. So perhaps share a little bit about your early journey.
Sure, happy to. And first of all, thank you very much for having me on the podcast, David. It's really a pleasure to be here. So to take it back to the beginning, I did undergraduate work in chemical engineering at UC Berkeley, and really was always interested at that intersection between, you know, really difficult technologies and commercial potential. And so I got involved pretty early on in a program that was a joint program between several Singapore universities and UC Berkeley, focused specifically on increasing sustainability in the tropics. And I was lucky enough to work on kind of the material science angle of solving that problem, alongside someone that would ultimately become the CTO of the company, Lance Brockway, as well as one of the three co-founders. And so this was an interesting position in the program because we were looking at an inherently mechanical problem, making air conditioning and refrigeration equipment more energy efficient from a chemistry and advanced materials perspective. So it was intersecting multiple disciplines. Right. And through a lot of trial and error and a lot of early failure, figured out a way to affect change in these systems that ultimately we realized had commercial potential far beyond just that first application. And so because that was ultimately the direction I'd always wanted to go, and Lance, the co-researcher with me at the time, felt similarly, we decided to build a company out of it. We got the company started with, if you believe it or not, a $100,000 a pitch competition that we won in 2016. Okay. That allowed us to actually step out of the university and start building the business. And ever since then, I've been focused on growing the company, fundraising, building our leadership team, and bringing on some fantastic clients, such as the ones that we have today. We've been able to sort of expand beyond those first applications since then and are really pursuing our dream of building this company.
Yeah, no, awesome. Again, I'm really keen to dig into the technology, but it always really fascinates me about the element of both decision and to some extent luck that most of us entrepreneurs experience along with challenges in the early stages. But so did you always anticipate that you'd be either an entrepreneur and or on the commercial side of things, or had you set out to be more of a scientist? Because clearly you have that, you know, technical background that got you to those early conversations with Lance and elsewhere. But did you always see yourself as a business owner or an entrepreneur? Is this something that happened kind of by chance or accident?
Yeah, great question. So the very clear answer on that is that my intention all the way through, even from very, very early in my academic career, I suppose you could say, is I always saw chemical engineering and chemistry training or education as a means for me to speak the language such that I could interface with really talented technologists, but ultimately be the person that brought them the resources and the organization and the attention necessary to make their technologies a real commercial success. So in simplistic right. form, I've always wanted to do what I'm doing right now. I didn't always know that that was going to be in the role of strictly an entrepreneur versus a business leader. That, you know, may morph and change through the course of my career, but I've actually found that I really love this format of it, of building the company from the beginning and taking it to its initial commercial success and scaling beyond there. So no, I've always wanted to be building companies. Understanding the technology, from my perspective, is a means to an end. That's not my number one focus.
Okay. Okay, super. Well, as I said, that's hugely interesting. We recently had a Dr. Pete Armstrong on the podcast, and he kind of found himself in similar shoes to yourself, but always was kind of by accident. So it's just fascinating as to how companies start. Going on then to the pitch you suggested, and you know, $100K of pre-seed money, I guess, at that stage is hugely useful, I'm sure you found. But how did you find yourself? Was that just, you know, that pitch, somebody came looking for you, you stumbled across it? How did you find yourself in that pitch competition in the first place?
Yeah, another good question. So we were pursuing multiple different avenues to start building towards the commercial success that we wanted to see, so start really building the company. And we're involved in a couple of different areas. But this was one that was actually a jointly sponsored event between UC Berkeley and the Department of Energy. So it was called the Clean Tech University Prize. So very fitting for the podcast that we're on today. And, you know, again, to some extent, you know, there's elements of luck that are involved with these things, right? So it was the first year that Berkeley was going to be hosting this particular pitch event, which is hosted at a number of universities around the U.S., and because of that, Berkeley decided to put in $50K to match the $50K from the Department of Energy. So it happened to be a winner-takes-all situation with a bigger pile of cash than you would typically see. And we just really went for it, put everything into it because we saw how much of an opportunity it was. Ended up winning, and that was the first kind of seed money into the company.
Yeah, which is hugely useful. And we'll return perhaps a little bit to the journey, but perhaps it's a good time to share with the audience now a little bit more about the technology as it stands at the moment. So can you tell us a little bit around the solutions that you have, the problems that you're solving, and what positive impact that has on the climate crisis we face?
Sure. So really happy to. In a nutshell, what we're doing at Nelumbo is making products hyper-resistant to the elements, higher performance than ever before, and environmentally sustainable. So three different things we want to bring to many different products in the world. And we're doing that through the creative application of nanostructure. Nanostructure is something that can really unleash powerful properties for products. So it can make products like planes that never have frost or ice on the wings, products like air conditioners that are resistant to corrosion, so they don't leak super high global warming potential refrigerants into the atmosphere, production processes and systems that use far less energy and resources. And nanostructure enables these kinds of properties because it can do things like extreme water repellency or water attractive features, what's commonly known as hydrophobic or hydrophilic surface properties, very high corrosion resistance, frost and ice free materials, potentially even optical properties in some scenarios. So there's a list of different value propositions nanostructure is known to provide on surfaces. But there's a gap in the marketplace. There is no really good technique for applying nanostructure to large, complex products at a very low cost point and without using toxic or accumulatory chemistries. Really, the only known techniques to apply high-precision nanostructure are mainly lithographic or what are called templated techniques, which are very expensive. They're limited to very small, planar surfaces, and they typically rely on toxic chemistries. So that's what we've evolved this company into solving. It's a much bigger problem. It's how can we create really a toolkit of different manufacturing techniques and chemical processes that allow our clients, which are companies which manufacture and sell physical products, to apply nanostructure to their products, typically for the first time. So what that does is it allows them to bring all these capabilities I discussed before to their products for the very first time. Or they can bring those value propositions at a much higher threshold of performance to their products. So if you're able to put nanostructure onto a surface, you can create not just a water repellent or hydrophobic material, but the most water repellent material that's ever been commercially available. So that's really, when you boil it down, we do one of those two things for our clients. We're either bringing them value propositions they can't access today by any means in the marketplace due to a performance or cost limitation, or mm-hmm. we're bringing them a value proposition they can access, but that is currently at such a low level of performance that it's not worth it for their product.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's really fascinating. Again, my clean tech journey started a long time ago, back in 2007, in solar, and has evolved through batteries and energy storage. And I'm certainly not a chemist or a scientist in any way, shape, or form, but became really interested in sort of chemistries, particularly through batteries. But now, increasingly, surface materials, nanotechnologies are showing that they can be hugely beneficial. We had on recently again a company Exeger, who are creating, I think I mentioned before, coatings which are self-powering for renewables, essentially solar-powered coatings. So again, in your, I should say, moving forward, and we'll touch on that later, there are numerous applications for Nilumbo's technology. At the moment, You say primarily in and around heating, ventilation, air conditioning, which I read just this week, I think around 10% of global emissions. It was a significant number, or it was maybe number 10 in a list of sort of high impact energy consumption uses that people don't necessarily think about. And it's also, I guess, a bit of a circular thing, because the hotter it gets, the more aircon we need, and the more aircon it needs, the more we're contributing to the problem.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's a few things that I can touch on in cooling, but you hit the nail on the head. So yes, it's the first market that we've started to commercialize this technology into, although we do see many different applications. Two, cooling is a really big problem for the climate challenge, and is also one that's, it's very unsexy. It's something that not a lot of new technologies have been adapted into the cooling industry for a very long time. And even the models like what Tesla used to disrupt the automotive industry, where you start out with a really high-end vehicle that you create an appeal around, and then you move down to mass market to really solve the climate problem, that strategy really can't work in HVAC or refrigeration, because you don't have the same level of attachment to a cooling system that a consumer does to a car, or even that an airline company has to an airplane, which is another example of a pretty long cycle, significant emitter, a significant piece of the climate challenge. And you also hit the nail on the head in terms of saying that there's an increasing demand for cooling because it's getting warmer outside, in very simple terms, which then creates an increasing and compounding problem for the climate, which is further exacerbated because in a lot of the big developing economies around the world, people are starting to get access to a amount of the disposable income they previously did not have. And what do you think the first thing they buy is? Either an air conditioner or a refrigerator, almost every single time. Because it's one of the biggest ways to shift your quality of life if you're moving from lower class to middle class with a relatively small amount of disposable income. So the problem is there, and it's basically the industry is not geared to solve it because they've kind of plateaued their existing methods of innovation. The advancing mechanical design further in an air conditioning system is something that can be done, but it doesn't differentiate manufacturers from one another. And often they don't see it. They can't use it in order to actually achieve a differentiated price point in the market. That's just the reality of it. So it's a huge problem. And I'll just speak briefly on what we're doing to solve it or solve a big piece of it. So two things. When an air conditioning system operates, or a refrigeration system, which are effectively the same, one is just operating at a much lower temperature set point, there are a number of different surface challenges that occur. Things like water accumulation on components, corrosion from contaminants that you have in the air, mold, frost and ice in low temperature systems. All of these surface challenges contribute to a significant decline in the energy efficiency of a cooling system from where it was when you pulled it out of the box. It can be 30, 50% or more decline in the energy efficiency of those systems within the first 6 months of operation.
Really? Right.
And you can have acute problems with things like frost and corrosion that lead to premature component failure and therefore system failure in the field. And the reason this matters for the climate challenge is because when you have, and there's a particular component in a cooling system called a heat exchanger. If you have a heat exchanger that has a corrosion issue and leaks, that is a refrigerant leaking out of there, going into the vapor phase. that has a global warming potential 10,000 times to sometimes 20,000 times higher than carbon dioxide that's going directly into the environment. So you've got both an energy problem and you've got a significant direct emissions problem.
Yeah.
So the way that we're solving this is we're developing the materials that can be applied to components like heat exchangers that mean they don't have these problems of water accumulation, frost and ice, mold, and corrosion. We can do things like increase the energy efficiency of a heat exchanger by making it more effectively shed water and frost by 25% or more. Those are third-party results, things that we verified in the lab and how we're starting to verify in field trials. And we can increase the lifetime of these products, the overall system, by 3x or more by solving some of the acute corrosion challenges. So those are the two big pieces of it, the energy and the emissions of cooling that we're trying to solve. And we think our solution is advantageous because it's got a really great performance versus price point. Because we're putting a relatively incremental cost adder in the form of a low-cost chemical process into this system, but we're able to pretty thoroughly solve these problems around frost and ice and water accumulation, you get a big bump in efficiency for a relatively small cost adder. And from our experience, those types of innovations are what's necessary to move the cooling landscape forward.
Yeah. I guess some of the challenges, going back to sort of the early stages, you have some pre-seed money, but as we touched on before, the HVAC market is a long and very established one. How do some guys working out of a garage start to make inroads into selling a solution of that nature into a very established market?
Yeah, another good question. It came down to, in the early days of the company, a lot of perseverance through many different changes. So just to do the simple outline, when we started the company, we were almost purely focused on energy efficiency, and we were using almost entirely a water repellency approach, which I won't go into the details of, but was fundamentally not something that was going to work for the way that the market was structured. So we needed to evolve what we were doing to focus much more on frost and ice and focus much more on corrosion, which are the bigger problems in the industry. So a lot of early pivots, a lot of things we learned that made us kind of need to change direction. But we were never solely focused on the technology for the technology's sake. We started the company to really build a business. And so we were always fine with the idea of switching our approach or needing to take some more time developing in order to reach something that was truly valuable to the market. Then what we realized was that the way that the market is structured, and again, we won't go into tons of detail on this, but the way that the market's structured is we would need partners that are good at development and verification of new products and new technologies to really enter this industry. And so that's some of the work that we really started to do about 2 to 2.5 years ago was take what we had at that point and start building those relationships, one of which is public. So it's something you can see on our website. We have a very good relationship with a company called Danfoss. Danfoss is a multi-billion dollar supplier of air conditioning and refrigeration components all over the world. They're one of the most well-respected brands in the industry. We're very excited to be one of their partners. And the way that works is we can work with Danfoss to develop and qualify these products and ultimately bring them to market to a number of different leading OEMs. And that kind of approach has worked well for us in the industry. It's given us a level of respect, amongst other things, that's allowed us to start entering the industry.
So that throws up a couple of ideas or questions, one of which is, as a startup company CEO, there are sort of dozens of hats that you wear and plates to be spinning. Aside from, starting to reach out to organizations, what were the biggest challenges that you faced in those early stages? As you say, you had this pre-seed money, but there's still an awful long way to go. So perhaps you can share some of the biggest challenges you had in those first 2 or 3 years before you got to have that relationship with Danfoss.
Sure, yeah. And I expect many of these are similar across many startup companies and particularly ones that are in the kind of climate tech or deep technology space. But, scaling up the technology to a level that actually mattered to somebody in the industry. So, lab scale, benchtop demo, while it might be convincing to us, it is not going to convince someone externally. So getting the funding and the people to get to a large enough scale where it starts to matter, developing relationships with the right third-party labs that are trusted by the industry, such that when those tests are completed, you really can convince a partner to come on board. Recruiting the first 3, 5, 10 people to the company. We're now, as of today, an 18-person company. We doubled our headcount last year. We might ultimately double our headcount this year, depending on commercial milestones that we want to hit. So we've now started to hit that kind of steady stride of scaling the business and starting to bring on and sign on more clients. But in the early days, pre-revenue, pre-clients, convincing those first few people to join the company, again, to the point earlier about the kind of perception of the HVAC industry, when that was our first and our only application we were focused on for this technology platform, we really had to sell the big business that we wanted to build. And that's exactly what we do want to do. So that wasn't hard per se, but had a lot of failures there. So I expect pretty typical things, right? Proving that we were real to an external partner, scaling up the technology, realizing that we needed to develop it further in certain areas, and then attracting those first few team members that were willing to do something this audacious, but also to, I think, the point you made when you opened the phone call, David, or the podcast here. It's a relatively little known, relatively low visibility space, particularly 4 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. In the last year, cooling is all of a sudden on the radar for, every climate focused company, seems there's a new climate focused fund, investor fund popping up every week now. That was not the case 4 years ago. So it really did take some early employees that were early team members that were really, really visionary in that regard.
Yeah. I think those are the two issues that consistently come across, both in terms of the guests on the podcast and clearly the people and the companies we work with day to day. So, again, as you appreciate, as a CEO of a headhunting company in the clean tech space, we work with a lot of companies at those early stages and understand the challenges of bringing some hugely talented people into what is essentially a high risk situation. So that's always a challenge. Talent's always a big challenge, and of course, finance is the other one, and how you go about that. So did you make a particular choice to seek an industrial investor partner versus a VC? Again, just some ideas in terms of how that came about, the relationship with Danfoss, and why you chose to go through, or did you choose to go through funding from an industrial partner as opposed to a VC or a fund?
Yeah, so another great question. First of all, right, even now, with kind of the renaissance we're seeing in the climate tech or green technology space, this is still not something that you would see a traditional venture capitalist be very focused on, right? This is not their bread and butter. And so we knew from founding the company, and we certainly, this was reinforced as we went forward, knew that we were going to have to attract folks that either deeply cared about and understood the problem in the first market that we were focused on, or really believed in us and the technology or some combination thereof. And that's what we kind of consistently found. So if you go and talk to or see any of the financial investors that came into the company early and more recently, it's really on a belief in the team, in the company itself, agnostic of what we're doing. And then it's a belief that the technological approach that we've developed is something that has the potential to be a huge solution or many solutions for a lot of different products. And that's what we're actually driven to go and do. We're not fundamentally motivated to do a single application as a company. We want to build this into a much, much bigger play. And that's a risky and therefore potentially rewarding endeavor. So folks have gotten on board with that. And then to your point about Danfoss, so yes, they came in as an investor in our Series A financing, or seed financing, which was the first institutional money into the company. And this is something that we've actually seen really good success with, is having our early commercialization partners, which, by the way, not all of which are public. Danfoss is one of the ones that's public, so I can speak a little bit more freely about it. But having our early commercialization partners, when it's mutually desirable, participate in the equity of our company is something that has really incentivized long-term success. Now, long-term focus, I should say, and a long-term mindset. this is not something we would do. And I think this is advice that many entrepreneurs get. So I'm not reinventing the wheel here. This is not something we would do if we were in a situation where any particular strategic investor was driving the terms of a financing. So we've always set up our financings where financial investors are driving the terms, you know, they're the ones leading the round. And then we ask for participation or bring in strategic investors that desire to be part of the company's equity as part of that round once it's been structured. And there's a number of reasons for that. But again, I think most folks are well aware of those. So.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that a good industrial partner is worth far more than the cash that they bring to the table, of course. And and interestingly, Danfoss, one of the earlier podcasters with Kimo Rama from now with Danfoss, but previously with a company that was invested in that were developing electric drivetrains for heavy transport, including shipping.
Oh, cool.
So Danfoss, as you say, is a global conglomerate, but clearly very committed to support startups and young companies who are bringing technologies like this to the market.
Yeah, exactly. We've had a great experience with those guys, and we see it as a solution that can be scaled across a number of different products. And that's typically what we're looking for at Nilumbo is where we can identify a partner of ours that has not one but several different products or big market problems that they they're probably not going to be able to solve with their existing toolkit. Because then what we can bring to the table is a roadmap of opportunity for that. We can say, let's focus on, problem A first. Let's solve that together. And then once that's solved and proven, you can go tell that story in your organization. We can get many more resources to work with and solve problems B, C, and D, which are probably a lot harder, but ultimately yield tons of value. So that's what we look for, and it's what we've set up in pretty much every one of our commercial partnerships.
Okay. And again, are you able to share in terms of future commercial model, whether you're looking to license the IP or technology, or do you plan to produce and sell the coatings or substrates to manufacturers?
Yeah, good question. So we have focused on building a model that is scalable across a number of different product lines that in a lot of cases have pretty diversified customer bases. So typically today, this varies a little bit based on the particular supply chain, actually, typically we see. But typically today, the split of responsibilities is that we are bringing on partners that bring manufacturing, sales, and distribution to the relationship. And we at Nilumbo will bring the intellectual property that drives this new product that's enabled by our materials. We will bring the market discovery and analysis and early prototyping and scale up, so proof of concept to prototype services, such that we can go from it's marrying those two things that small companies and big companies are both really good at. So we will do all of the work to get from very early proof of concept up to a full scale prototype very, very quickly, and we can iterate many times as we go through that process. Mm-hmm. Once we've hit that stage where it's full prototype scale and it's been proven, and we understand there's a market need, we will then go to market with that partner who we're typically scaling up a manufacturing line at their facility or in a close toll or contract manufacturing facility. So in other words, we at Nilumbo today are in a licensing and service model. We do not imagine that will be the model we use to grow to, 100 million in sales. That's what gets us from our first application to our first several. And then when we're at that point in time, right, we've always thought, David, about how do we get to the next threshold. Once we're at that point in time where we've proven this platform across a couple of different diversified product lines, we believe and we have seen that we will be able to access the next level of resources, which means we can build a more involved business model in the product lines that suit us.
Okay. Oh, that's really interesting. So without breaking cover, of course, and I appreciate there are some, as you said before, some partners you already have which are under wraps, but which are the next logical product areas or solutions where you anticipate being active? You touched on one, I think, with aircraft, but are there any particular other applications which are we may see the product coming to light in sooner rather than later?
Let's think a year about which ones I want to speak about today. So within cooling, even there's a number of different products that we can work on, and one particular class of products that we're very focused on with Danfoss other types of products that are components, I should say, that we are focused on with other partners. So you mm-hmm. should see over the next couple of years a pretty broad range of Nilumbo-enabled products entering the cooling market. And that's exciting to us, right? That means we've got a solution that can really solve big problems for this space, agnostic of which particular component designer type it's applied to. So that's some of the work that we're doing. But then on the outer edge, so on the kind of flip side, just to give a taste of one of the other areas that we are spending some time in, we are looking into the sustainable textile space. And this is something that, you know, I'm not going to be able to go into detail on today.
Sure.
But effectively, the challenge in that market is that the existing solutions all rely on some type of fluorinated chemistry, which is toxic and bioaccumulatory, so bad for plants and animals, bad for humans. I think the latest report was that something like greater than 98% of Americans statistically have PFOA in their systems, which is known to kick off, be an early thing that can kick off certain types of cancer. So this is something that, you know, end customers, regulators are starting to try and pull out of products. And we believe we have a solution for that space. So it gives you kind of a sense that we can work in industrial intensive spaces, and we can also go on to, you know, a little bit faster moving markets that are fabric or flexible substrate based. So it's a pretty adaptable technology.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons we decided to take a look at this, this second big industry next, is we wanted to prove to the world how far ranging this could be.
Sure. I guess it's an interesting, we throw up obvious ones are like Intel and Gore-Tex, where the essentially the your brand is associated with what's inside the bigger product. And again, that was, I think, came to the fore with the guys who are creating the sort of energy generating coatings. Are we likely to see products with Nilumbo inside or some variation on that sort of marketing ploy? Are you happy to be entirely on the radar?
Yeah. So I think what you're going to see is less so the Nilumbo inside, but you're going to see our brand on specific products that are moving into their respective markets. And this is a longer, you know, I'm happy to do a whole other podcast on this, but we actually see that this is going to be one of the primary ways that new materials technology moves into the market. This actually, I think, is reinforced by your point about the other guys that you spoke with. Because of some of the learnings of the initial clean tech boom and bust in the 2008 to 2010 cycle, where the big takeaway was that doing a build, own, and operate model, in other words, taking on the functional staff or responsibility for an entire business model yourself without partnering as a climate tech or even material science focused company, is really, really hard to make successful. And so we've, from the beginning, tried to make sure that we don't have to do that in order to get to commercial revenues with this company. And that's why we've been so open to structuring these partnerships that can get us there.
Yeah.
I think that other companies that we are also starting to see this are taking that approach. And what that will ultimately mean, if those companies are broadly accessible, is that you'll start to see many more products in various industries that are, you know, X brand is the headline brand, but then there is Y startup company or Y smaller company that is the kind of key enabling ingredient that makes that brand better, more successful, more productive, more climate friendly, whatever it may be. I'm actually, you know, I'm very, that to the extent that that's part of our, you know, quote unquote secret sauce, I'm very happy to share that, because the more companies that are using that model to get new advanced materials to actual end customers, that it's not competitive with us, the better it is for us. It's reinforcing that this is a viable way to actually use capital to make a fundamental physical difference in the world, which is what we're all about.
Okay, perfect. And looking at the next, you talked before about always looking at where next and what's the next milestones. And if we look at Nilumbo in the next couple of years, where do you see the biggest challenges and the biggest opportunities? Where will we see you hopefully in a couple of years' time?
Yeah, so we actually just recently closed a significant round of funding, which you'll be seeing announced in just the next couple of weeks here. So that's the first thing you'll hear from us. But the reason I say that is because that funding is dedicated to growing these existing business opportunities, which I've already spoken about today, moving those products actually into the market, expanding the platform to our next 1 to 2 applications. We're not trying to boil the ocean here, but we want to build ourselves a small portfolio of really excellent, differentiated, high margin opportunities to prove this platform overall is very valuable, and identifying what the next big step of our company is. So what we're going to be doing, between 4 and 6 years from now. So the next 2 or 3 years are going to be a little bit of kind of continue to execute on the existing things that you already know about, as we talked about that today, and then turn the crank a couple more times on this model that we've set up, which we now have the resources, have an amazing team to go and do to build out that portfolio. What we're going to be doing between 4 and 6 years from now, we've got a lot of ideas, but we haven't decided on the specific next phase of the company. I don't anticipate, we'll continue to just do the exact same model for, deals N through 7 to N through 20, because that model ends up, doesn't continue to scale in the same way. I expect you'll see kind of an evolution of our business as we move forward.
Okay. And looking at the broader context, because again, it's been really fascinating to see how material science in particular has started to become more, I won't say mainstream quite just yet, but more people are more aware of what can be achieved through material science rather than, again, perhaps more physical solutions to address the energy consumption and energy generation markets. Is there anything in particular that you see over the next 2 or 3 years that are going to make some step changes in the broader climate battle that we have?
You mean, just to make sure I understand, by way of specifically in material science or more broadly?
I guess just more broadly in terms of, we're all chipping away at in our own way at this problem. From our perspective, it's clearly helping companies to build the teams that go and solve the problems. You have a company which is solving problems. Do you think we'll get to where we need to be? And are there any particular milestones you see on the horizon? Do you see perhaps that material science will be much more to the fore and much more instrumental in the change than perhaps some more obvious things like Tesla and windmills?
Yeah. Let me think about that. So first of all, yes, I think that material science is going to play a big role, a bigger role than previously going forward. A lot of different reasons for that, but a lot of it comes down to, I think that the cycles for physical innovation, particularly for chemical and chemistry innovation, are starting to be sped up very significantly from what's been done by merging in digital technology in the course of the last 10 years or so. So effectively the chemical or the advanced materials industry is starting to catch up. And I think that makes it more feasible to move some of the really advanced technologies in the materials field, which have been, to put it simply, very trapped in academic environments into it increases the ROI and lowers the upfront investment. So it makes it feasible to actually motivate those early stage technologies into the market, and there's a huge push to have solutions. So I think that that's one piece of it. So yes, I think it's going to play a big role. Besides that, I think energy storage, and these are things that I'm sure many folks in the podcast have said, but things like energy storage are going to play a huge role in a variety of different formats. So it's not just going to be existing lithium ion batteries. We're going to see many different ways that we can store energy and there's not going to be one, again, I'm sure most folks know this, there's not going to be one size fits all solutions. Other than that, I think that carbon capture and carbon markets are going to be play a big role in the next 10 years. And what I should have said at the beginning was, yes, I fundamentally believe we're going to get there. In terms of solving the climate problem, will it be the next 10 years? I'm not sure, but I think we're going to make a heck of a lot of progress, and that's exciting to me. I think I'd love to think about it a little bit more, but I think those are the things I would briefly point to.
Appreciate that. No, absolutely. I'm super excited and actually optimistic. I guess you have to be A, to be an entrepreneur, and B, to choose to be in cleantech rather than some other sector. But that's a message, again, that comes through clearly from the people that we speak to on the podcast, is you really have a genuine anticipation that both your own solutions and or others out there will get us to where we need to be, and that's really promising. Certainly, I see, and we work with a number of companies in and around, both from a digital digitalization of energy and mobility, creating significant changes. But it's really good just to go back to chemistry, making some real advances, both in the most obvious things like batteries and long duration storage and other aspects, but as you say, in areas where energy efficiency is going to make the biggest difference, more so perhaps than energy generation through clean sources. So it's hugely exciting, and I really appreciate what you've been able to share with us today, and we very much look forward to seeing news on the funding and next steps for Nilembo. I guess I always like to close with a little bit of going back to your journey where we started, to see if there are any particular either books, mentors, thought leaders, or things which continue to inspire you on what is clearly a very challenging journey as a startup CEO.
Sure. Yes, I do a lot of reading, and I tend to gravitate towards, there's two different sides of it. One, I really enjoy geo-economic political work. So, and like the intersection of those three different pieces is very personally interesting to me. It's less relevant to specifically what I do at, Nilembo day to day, but it's something that I'm personally interested in. And I also read a lot of, and this is something if you ask anyone at Nilembo, they're gonna know it. They might even roll their eyes. I read a lot of science fiction and fantasy. So the familiar stories, I'm sure everyone would recognize. I've read those dozens of times, and also really enjoy discovering new excellent works in science fiction and fantasy. Have always loved learning about other worlds or other universes, and to the extent I can figure out how we can advance the physical world that we live in to someday meet or exceed that. That really excites me on a higher level. In terms of mentors and people that I'm really excited to work with. So I'll just name a couple. There are really too many to name than I could on even a 40-minute podcast. And there's been so much help from so many selfless people along the way. So I would want to say thank you to all of them. But just quickly, I think it's pretty well known that Arno Harris is one of the guys that I started working with early in the life cycle in Nilembo, who has had a ton of success himself in the solar space and generally in the energy space. Actually, Arno is one of the founders and was the CEO all the way to the exit of a company called Recurrent Energy, which made waves in solar.
Yeah.
He's someone I deeply admire both as a professional, as an executive, and as a person. And that became, because we started working together so early, that became really a model for me of the other kinds of leaders that I wanted to seek out and start to work with. One other that definitely falls into that category is also someone that you've had the pleasure of interviewing on this podcast, and that's Mike Hopkins. Mike is also someone that I equally started working with early in the life cycle of Nilembo. Really, really respect what he's done professionally. Find every venture he's worked on super interesting, but even more so than that, I think he's just an incredible person, and so much so that when we Mike was an advisor to me and an advisor to Nilembo for about 18 months prior to our first significant institutional financing, and after we went through that, we did an independent board member search. And out of about 20 different people, Mike's name came to the top and was ultimately someone that had unanimous support by not just me, but every single member of the board and every single existing investor. And we had the pleasure of asking Mike to join the board at Nilembo. So Mike's been an independent director in Nilembo for the last almost 2 years now. And that's been even more fun and has been a huge, huge helpful point to me, huge person in my life. And someone I'm very thankful for.
Sure. No, as we said before, I've had the pleasure of working with Mike and speaking with him and meeting with him a few times and having some mentoring from him also. And that's those key individuals, and there are obviously many hundreds of them out there, but are so important, not just because of what they've done, but because of the knock-on effects of who they inspire and who they support and who they share. So it's always good to get a name check for some. As you say, it can be challenging because there are so many, but I appreciate you sharing those couple of ideas. Listen, I've taken a lot of your time. Happy to if there's any other final thoughts on closing, but it's been great to hear your journey so far, and we look forward to the next steps from yourself and from the company.
Well, thank you. And likewise, I really, was excited about joining the podcast. I've had a great time with you, David, and thank you for the opportunity.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Liam Berryman and that you're inspired by the range of technologies and companies out there really making inroads into the technologies that change the way we live for the better and for a more sustainable planet. It's supporting these companies that drives me personally and the team at Hyperion Executive Search. We build the teams that change the world. I hope you join me next week for another episode.